Accession number 28354, wheel number 1.
Sir William, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to make a contribution to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive, which is much appreciated. Can we start, please, with your full name and your date of birth, and then where you were born?
Certainly. My full name is William Dunner O'Brien, and I was born on the 13th of November 1916 in Faversham in Kent. My parents, my mother was a Maltese lady. Her name was Ines Parnis, the daughter of a judge in Malta. And my father was in the Connaught Rangers. However, he was killed on the Somme 6 months before I was born. So I never knew my father. They met in Malta, obviously, since my mother was Maltese. As the Connaught Rangers passed through Malta on some occasion, I don't know the story. Where do I go from that?
Carry on, please. Yeah. With I'm most interested that you lost your father before you knew him. This obviously must have had. How were you brought up then, as a consequence of that?
I had two brothers and a sister, and my mother brought us up. We lived in quite a largish house that my father had built in Faversham, and the answer is that I was got rid of pretty quickly. I went to my preparatory school at the age of six, and because I bothered my mother so much that my brothers were at school, I wanted to go there too. So my first triumph in life, actually, is winning the 100 yards under seven. There were only two competitors, and in the subsequent year, we ran the 100 yards under eight, and there were still only two competitors. I won the first time, he won the second time. His name was Michael McGorris, and he went into the Gurkhas. The prep school was St. Anthony's Eastbourne, a Catholic preparatory school of about 80 boys, which has disappeared now. And from there, I went on to Dartmouth. Why did I go to Dartmouth? Why did I go into the Navy? The only reason I can ever find it is that I saw my brother in uniform. He was 7 years older than me, and he went to Dartmouth, and I saw him in uniform, and I said, I'm going to do that. I don't think... I did have an uncle who was in the Navy and actually was at the Battle of Jutland, but I was too young to really connect with him and didn't know him that well. So it's my brother's beautiful uniform.
Just before we move on then to Dartmouth, what impact financially or in any other way did your father's early death, so far as you're concerned, have on you?
This is one of the strange things. I never missed not having a father. It never seemed to me extraordinary at school or anything that other children had fathers and I didn't. I've never understood this looking back. I felt I should have missed not having a father. I don't think I did. Perhaps that was my mother did the job rather well, I don't know. Financially, my mother managed. My grandmother left some a certain amount of money. There was a brewery, actually, in the background, which my father would have inherited, but as he died, he didn't. And that went to the other brother, who became an extraordinarily rich man. Whereas we didn't. Perhaps it was that's our good luck. No, there was enough money. At Dartmouth, I was in the Exmouth term, can we stop a second? Well, it's actually 1930 I went to Dartmouth. And the You did roughly three years and two terms at Dartmouth. A curious arrangement, really, segregated by age. Each term remained, there were 37 of us. We all remained together, and we were the first term, the second term, and right up to the 11th term. Every cadet had to double past every other senior cadet's gun room. So in your first term, you double past 10 other gun rooms, the gun rooms being... the spaces that were allocated to each term. And as you slowly went up, you did less and less doubling, except that you had to double between every single class. You had to salute every officer or master that you met, and that was very difficult when you're carrying a lot of books, doubling along a corridor to go from science to French or whatever. And then you had to salute Mr. Bunting, the geography master, as he came by. Very strict. There were things called the guff rules. That's to say, if you were in your... You couldn't put your hands in your pockets ever until you got to the ninth term, I think. You had to button up your blazer, couldn't have it open. You couldn't wear a scarf until you were in the first 15 or the first 11. You couldn't walk the quickest way up to the sports field. You had to go the long way round till you were in the ninth term or you were in the first 11, when you could go the quick way. All sorts of things like that. And there were, you had cadet captains who were seen more senior cadets than you. Each term had two cadet captains, a term cadet captain and a cadet captain. And they had really very, very complete rule over the term. And there was a system of ticks. Each cadet captain had a book. You had your names in the book. And if you misbehaved in any way, you got a tick. And when you got four ticks, you got four cuts with a cane. And that was done at night. After you turned in, you'd have a shout of O'Brien, turn out, and out you'd go and you'd get your bottom thwacked with a cane. I found it very painful. I didn't like it, and I took jolly good precautions not to be beaten. But some could seem to just bounce off without any problem at all, which I never understood. I thought it hurt. I thoroughly enjoyed Dartmouth. The sporting facilities were tremendous, and I liked sport. And in fact, I was successful at home. I was top of my term the whole way through. Though, curiously enough, I always found this interesting. I was never top in any subject, but I seemed to average up above them. This strange arrangement, usually one has. So I never won anymore in any subject. But there I was at the top of the list always each year. We had two officers. The first one was Lieutenant Commander Edward, who was an extraordinarily nice man, but totally inappropriate after 13 year olds.
Why was that?
Oh, he danced. He couldn't control us at all. We teased him when we led him a dance, which I always felt a bit sad about because he was such a nice person, and I remained friends with him until his death afterwards. But he wasn't a very successful naval officer. Then there was St. John Cronin, who was an extraordinary one. And just as I don't think Edward was suitable to look after 13 and a half year olds, we were amazed when Cronin came. Cronin was entirely spherical. He drank quantity, about 5'6", I suppose. He had a really wide range of expletives and language. And he taught us all sorts of strange games and things, old naval games at the seamanship class. We very rarely weren't doing seamanship. We were playing extraordinary games like Priest of the Parish, which is an antique naval game. But actually, I think he did us a world of good. He was a very experienced seaman, extremely good seaman, and just a funny, funny, spherical, fat, gin-sozzled man. That's unkind. He drank a lot of gin. I always remember one thing he said, which is, if you possibly can, he said, take over command of a ship that's had a mutiny, because you cannot do worse than your predecessor. And I did actually later on take over a ship which hadn't had a mutiny, but it had an extraordinarily bad captain. And I remember this, and it certainly worked, as far as I was concerned. I didn't do as badly as my predecessor, and it's quite a successful ship. I think that's probably it.
What was it, now you've mentioned that you liked Dartmouth a great deal,
yeah.
That you fitted in there, and also that you did quite well scholastically because you came to top. If you like, you were second in everything, and therefore, as a result, were top overall,
that's right,
if I can put it that way.
Yeah, that's right.
The thing that interests me was that you naturally would it be correct to say that you naturally enjoyed the communal ethos? You were already finding yourself at home in that.
Very much so, yes. It was very, it was what I said, a very infectious sort of ethos. It's still the days of empire, and somehow the whole system and the whole belief that there was nothing the Navy could not do, that it was the best Navy in the world that you'd entered into, and it was a vocation, not a career. All these sort of archaic thoughts were real and meant something, and as far as I'm concerned, made it a very interesting. Interesting, I don't know if that's the word, but anyway, I enjoyed it. I thrived at Dartmouth, I think.
And were there boys who didn't?
There were a few, but actually surprisingly few, considering that you were catching them at 13 and a half, when supposedly they can't possibly know their own mind, and when then running them through a sausage machine that was producing naval officers at the end of the 4 years, there were very few. In my term, there were... there's only one who was totally unhappy. He left the Navy as soon as we left Dartmouth and did what he ought to have done originally, which was join a dance band. He was a wonderful drummer and pianist. And he ran a dance band and subsequently became a BBC DJ, actually. After the war, he was a chap called... He changed his name to Bruce Windham, and if you woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning in the 1950s, he did the sort of early morning DJ... slot. I can think of one or two who weren't really happy, but on the whole, we were rather a contented lot. I think we got on well with one another.
And you were contented, notwithstanding that brutal might be too brutal a word to employ about Dartmouth, but certainly, would you say that it was more rigorous, less rigorous, or if you like, the norm for a public school, which is effectively what Dartmouth
I think
was.
It was more rigorous than the public school.
Was it?
In that you never went anywhere without falling in and marching to it. I don't think at a public school you had quite such strict social rules, guff rules, as they were called at Dartmouth. They really were very strict indeed.
This didn't trouble you?
No, it was part of it. That's how it was. Yes, it didn't really trouble me. No, there were injustices, I suppose, but not very many, and I don't think it did people too much harm.
You come towards the end of Dartmouth, and what happens?
You then went to sea in the training cruiser in HMS Frobisher. That was two cruises, 8 months, roughly in all, 2/3 of the year, and we went to. You joined up then, of course, with the direct entry cadets, the boys that were coming in at the age of 17 and a half, it was then, from public school or elsewhere, but actually mostly public school. And we joined up with them. That's interesting, really, because we remained throughout the training cruise at the time totally separate. We thought, you know, these were Johnny-come-latelys. I mean, they didn't know anything. We'd had 4 years of it by now, and there was tremendous rivalry. In fact, it's interesting that you couldn't tell the difference after a few, quite a short time. We did two cruises in the training cruise. The one we went to the West Indies, and one we went to the Baltic. There, much the same system went on as at Dartmouth. You were, instead of being in terms, you were now mixed up in age rather more, and you were in what were called parts of ship. I mean, I was a fore topman, and that meant you were in another gang of people that did everything together. I was dreadfully seasick, always. But I liked it, and again, I saw... in my four top division there was a most wonderful petty officer, a Hindi. This was a a really good trainer, and I think we all owed a great deal to that non-commissioned officer, like many people do. Filios Hend is the one I remember best. He never went ashore anywhere. He never spent a penny. Everything went back home to his family. And there were we going ashore and enjoying ourselves, and Filios Hend stayed on board and saved up. And I think throughout his entire naval career he must have done that. He was a great example, but he was a good man, a very upright man. He had as his lockerman a naval seaman, McCluskey, and the last thing McCluskey was an upright man, but he was the other side of the naval picture. We learnt a tremendous amount from McCluskey, of quite a different sort from what Petty Officer Hendy taught us.
So McCluskey taught you the wrinkles? Hmm? He taught you the wrinkles?
He taught us very much the wrinkles in lower deck language, yeah. I can't remember the story. There was some story about girls, I remember, in the West Indies, but I can't remember the whole of it, so never mind. Where do we go now?
Well, you're on your training cruises, Baltic and West Indies.
Yes.
At what point do you actually become commissioned as a midshipman?
You don't become commissioned as a midshipman, you become commissioned as a sub-lieutenant.
Right.
At the end of the time in the training cruiser, then you became an acting sub-lieutenant. Sorry, you still weren't commissioned, because you were only acting. It's when you became a proper, permanent sub-lieutenant that you got your commission from the King. And that was a little bit. I don't know how long that was ahead. Oh, yes, you had to get your watchkeeping certificate, that's right. So you went from the training cruiser and you went to sea as a sub-lieutenant. You were then, after 6 months or so, given a watchkeeping certificate. And then you could be rated sub-lieutenant permanent. I have no particular highlights of my time in the training cruiser. I resented that, so did everybody, that our leave was up at 7 o'clock. It's quite unimaginable now, today. We were 18 years old, and our leave expired at 7 p.m.
And you had to be back on board.
You had to be back on board. And I remember in Stockholm coming down to the jetty with an absolutely enchanting blonde Swedish girl, and having to get in the boat and go back at 7 o'clock, and seeing Lieutenant Commander, his name's gone, but anyway, one of the Lieutenant Commanders walking off with my girl on his arm, and feeling this really was unjust. And I suppose it was all good discipline again, and I don't think you could do it now. Perhaps it's a pity you can't. From the training cruiser, I went to... I was quite good rugby player, and when I went to see the appointments commander in the Admiralty, he said that I was wanted for the to continue to play for the United Services Club in Portsmouth, which I had been playing for. I've got something wrong here. Sorry, let me go back. Oh, well, no, I left the training. That's right, yes. And he said that therefore I would be given a rugger appointment. There were rugger appointments. People were appointed to ships in the Portsmouth Flotilla in order that they could play rugger and perhaps play for the Navy. Very, I don't think that again happens now much. But so I went to HMS Winchelsea, which was an old V&W World War I destroyer. She was a local flotilla and was the target boat for HMS Dolphin for the submarines. So we used to go out. It was a 9-to-4 job, so to speak, so she could go back and train for rugger. And you'd go out and they would fire torpedoes at us. They were then surface, and we would pick the torpedoes up and bring them back into harbour. It was a very mundane job. And I was a sub-lieutenant, very few officers in that ship. And the one thing I learnt in it was be careful with your signature. Because my captain, a Lieutenant Commander Harkness, I was the office boy and ran the office in the ship. And he had a rubber stamp for duplicate copies of letters with his initials on them, K. Harkness. But they weren't just his initials, they were a facsimile of his signature. So when I'd failed to send some report in, and the senior officer wrote back and said, you know, this isn't in by next week or in the in the Chittenden somewhere or another, I was able to conceal this from my captain by sending the report off and signing it very carefully with his own rubber stamp. It was extremely good facsimile, and it really almost looked like his signature. So I was very careful with my signature from then on. We only had three or four officers in that ship, and I played rugger for the United Services. And but we did go up to, we were sent up to Scotland, to the Firth of Forth, to act as guard ship, so to speak, for a submarine doing experimental dashes into a net. You know, the nets that used to be put across the entrances to harbours. And this submarine went at the nets and then caught it, and one saw all the boys going down, etc. And we were responsible for keeping contact with it in case anything dreadful happened. And I was, among other duties, the anti-submarine officer of that vessel. And so I was responsible for the ASDI, as it was then called. And somehow or other, I or somebody had lined the sonar up 180 degrees out. So when on the bridge, I thought it was pointing on the starboard beam, it was actually pointing on the port beam. So we weren't actually pinging on the submarine, we were just listening acoustically and as it went along. And I was reporting to the captain what was happening. And I could hear the submarine going along, and then obviously it hit the net, and I could hear through the thing that it hit the net. And then I said, the submarine's surfacing, as I could hear it blowing its tanks. And I said, it's coming up on the starboard beam, sir. And up it popped on the port beam. and that wasn't very good. What did we do then? Oh, so when we left Rosyth, we went down south again, and on a terrific gale off in the North Sea, and another destroyer being towed down to Chatham, a reserve ship being towed down from Chatham from Rosyth, broke away from its tow and went aground at Scarborough. That was quite fun. I was great relief because it meant we had to go into the Tyne and get out of this rough sea. I was being terribly, terribly sick. And I was sent down in a truck with a lot of sailors to strip this ship of anything that anybody might pinch, because she was high and dry on Scarborough Sounds, almost half a mile from the sea. The sea goes out a long way there. And there was this destroyer, HMS Walrus, sitting on the sand. And we walked out and we took all the necessary bits off, and we stayed the night in a hotel in Scarborough. That was interesting because I was greeted at the hotel by the proprietress, and this, of course, was Charles Lawton's sister. Lawton came from Scarborough, and his two sisters, and I can always remember being so sorry for this lady because she was exactly like her brother. She really wasn't very beautiful. From there, we then what did we do in the winter? So we went back down to Portsmouth again. By that time, I knew I had played for the Navy, but I knew I was not going to go on playing for the Navy. And I'm rather allergic to an awful lot of beer, and I found that the naval rugger teams, when they went and played away, they came back in a coach. They sang bawdy songs, which again didn't appeal to me terribly, and we stopped at every pub and drank more and more and more beer. And I didn't enjoy this at all. I thought it was a rotten. I wanted to get back and see my girlfriend. Mm. And so I went up to the Admiralty and said, please, I want a proper job, not this half-baked one. And I went out to the Mediterranean to HMS Garland. HMS Garland was a G-class destroyer, the first destroyer flotilla in the Mediterranean. Our captain was Commander Cecil Chatwin. Perhaps I'd better deal with Chatwin, because how much you want about personalities. I'm not very kind about this show.
I would like everything you'd like to give me, please. Yes, thank you. Before you tell me about Commander Chatwin, how you went up to the Admiralty to ask for a proper job,
yeah.
And how many Was it normal to say, look, I'm not happy in the post I'm in? And
you were always allowed to go and see your appointer. And I was subsequently appointed and did it, but he either took notice or he didn't take notice.
So even sub-lieutenants have appointments?
Yes.
They do, right.
Okay. I mean, there was an officer there who was appointing sub-lieutenants.
Yes.
Not quite as personal as my appointer sounds like. He was appointing... but yes, you had the entree to him, always.
Okay.
And it was... It was understood, and it remains so, that he would see anybody who wanted to see him.
But you now go out to the med.
Yeah. I got this wrong. To start with, the captain was a chap called Sloppy Williams, a Lieutenant Commander Williams, who was a delightful man. Sloppy was... I was only three or four months with Sloppy. He... great polo player. And... when we came into Malta Harbour, Williams would bring the ship into stern first. You went stern first down Sleema Harbour, stern first down the harbour, looking like a naval officer from his waist upwards. And that was all that showed externally from the bridge. And down below were jodhpurs or polo breeches and boots. And as soon as the first line was on the buoy, he didn't wait for the ship was secured. As soon as on the forecastle they said connected to the bow buoy, sir, he said number one take over, the first turn took over, and he went straight down the ladder. The dicer by that time would be alongside, and he'd jump in the ship's dicer and be paddled ashore and off he'd go and play polo. He was actually quite a good seaman, Williams. He also was quite careful to make sure things went well. We were doing a shoot once, which was a competition shoot of some sort, and a demonstration, I think. And he made me work it all out on the chart, exactly. So there was no question of distance. We were to be exactly in this place. So it was a sort of all pre-arranged, entirely phony shoot. It was quite successful, actually. It was against HMS Centurion, who was on a target ship. We came home in that ship and to Chatham, and that's where lots of the sailors had collected parrots and other tropical birds and were bringing them back. And there was a case of psittacosis in England somewhere, and they were immediately all parrots had to be destroyed. So everybody left the ship, and I was the only officer on board, because they all went on. I'd been back in England recently, so I was the last chap to go on leave. They all went off on leave, and there I was alone, officer of the day and in charge of the ship. When on board came gentlemen for the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries to destroy all the parrots on board, and they came with a tub and some gas, and this was all carried up to the forecastle. And then I got the quartermaster to pipe all birds to the forecastle, and not a bird turned up. There wasn't a single one in the ship. This Sergeant O'Brien was extremely embarrassed, because here was this superior man for the Ministry of Ag, and I didn't have a bird. And a three-badged able seaman, a proper old sailor, stepped forward and saved my life and said, I done it, sir. I couldn't bear the thought of all them birds being gassed. So I strangled them all humanely last night, sir. And the chap had to accept this. There wasn't a bird. No evidence to the contrary. And so they went away, and all the birds then came up from the magazines. That's a silly story. Then we recommissioned HMS Garland, and Cecil Chaplin came as captain, and a chap called Jack McBeath was the first lieutenant, who subsequently ended up as a rear admiral. Chaplin was another polo player, interestingly enough. He used to walk around with a little sort of short stick on his wrist, which he sort of exercised his polo wrist with as he walked around the ship. He also wore a monocle.
Yes.
Which he used to tremendous effect with defaulters. He was not a really very nice personality, this, and he could be pretty brutal. And a sailor standing in front of him having done some awful deed knew that he was really in for it when there was a plop on the sort of prie-dieu desk in front of the captain as his monocle fell out and he dropped it theatrically onto the paper, and then the sailor knew he was going to get God knows what punishment. He used it very well, but he wasn't he was strange. He had extraordinarily high standards, demanded tremendously high standards, but never supervised to make sure those high standards were achieved. So you suddenly found yourself in terrible trouble because you hadn't done this, you hadn't done